Mother cow. It's wonderful how with these classes as they evolve on Tuesday nights, and you just want to keep them going, and so you know you think of more and more topics to cover, and sometimes in Krishna consciousness those topics are something that you are just on the edge of your consciousness, and you bring them in to prepare a talk on it. And when you do it, when you do the research through the database and the books and all in the library, you realize that although it's peripheral in your consciousness, it's an essential feature of becoming Krishna conscious. It's an essential feature of becoming Krishna conscious. Like Ekadasi. If you don't observe Ekadasi, you will not become Krishna conscious. That's all there is to it. Lord Chaitanya asked his mother, she said, "What can I do for you?" And he said one thing, he said, "Observe Ekadasi." So it's like, you know, you're stretching, well, what can we talk about next week? Ekadasi. And as you go into it, you realize, actually, we knew it all along, but when you look at it closely, it's an essential component for becoming a pure devotee. Just like when Prabhupada turned it in and out and he said, "We become a pure devotee." He wasn't talking about, "Oh, I'm a pure devotee. I'm a pure devotee. Oh, I love Krishna so much." You know, Prabhupada's never talking about sentiment, at least not on this level. The sentiment that we experience when we're not observing Ekadasi, when we're not worshiping Tulsi, when we're not holding these principles deeply and reverently in our heart, the sentiments that we feel are not valid. They're not to be trusted. Later on, the sentiment of praying, of course, that's the real thing. And then also, he said, what does it mean to love the Guru? You just heard that, right? He didn't answer the question in terms of sentiment. He said it means to keep your vows. So, you know, what started out is just a set series of cultural presentations so that you know all the different aspects of Krishna conscious culture. But this is actually the culture of the kingdom of God. And if you want to go to the kingdom of God, you need to know the culture. That it's as simple as that. You know? The man is saying you can't take people from the West that are uncultured and make them Brahmins. And Prabhupada said, "Well, yes, I can. I can take the horse to water, and then if they drink it, then they're Brahmins." And so we've done Tulsi, and we realized how essential Tulsi is. You can't just take Tulsi as something that's around the temple that we just worship once in a while. We learned in the presentation about Tulsi that she organizes every pastime that goes on in the spiritual world. In Vrindavan, that's Tulsi's place. And she's in control of the breezes, the water, the aromas, everything. And whatever Radha's, Krishna's pastimes involve, Tulsi will have orchestrated all that. So whenever we see Tulsi, it's like, it's not just, "Oh yeah, there's Tulsi." She's got to be in the center of our heart, just like Krishna does. Following Ekadasi is not something to be taken lightly. And I was in the library. I was tempted to do it today instead of Mother Cow, but then I realized it's all important. It's all important. But I did one on Japa, and I did 57 slides and hardly even scratched the surface. I mean, it's so much, and it's so inspiring, and it's so important. It's so important. So if you want to become Krishna conscious, it takes a lifetime. It takes a lifetime. It takes a lifetime because these are arts. These are states of the heart. These are acknowledgments and appreciations which are shared by devotees everywhere, genuine devotees. And so, Mother Cow is also one of the principles of our Krishna conscious lifestyle. And I thought we'd do a show on that. One of the most important prayers that we say, whenever you do any kind of a puja, what do they call it, baby shower, housewarming, hair cutting, or even an initiation ceremony, or giving the Brahmin thread, when you're offering the last grains and ghee into the fire, this is what everyone says: Namo Brahmanya Devaya, Go Brahmanya Hitaya Cha, Jagat Hitaya Krishnaya, Govindaya Namo Namaha. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto Lord Krishna, who is the worshipable deity for all Brahminical men, who is the well-wisher of cows and brahmanas, and who is always benefiting the whole world. I offer my repeated obeisances to the personality of Godhead, known as Krishna and Govinda. He says the worshipable deity of all brahminical men. It doesn't say Brahmins, it says brahminical men. That means those who have the brahminical qualification. Someone may be born as a Brahmin, but he's not keeping Krishna in the center of his heart. So he's not actually a brahminical person. Someone else may not be born a Brahmin, but if he catches up and keeps Krishna in the core of his heart, then he is actually a brahminical man. And so it says Krishna is the heart of the brahminical man, but if you read it backwards, it says only those are brahminical men who have Krishna in their heart. It's not determined by birth. It's not determined not by birth. It's determined by whether you have Krishna in your heart. And then, in addition, Krishna is always the well-wisher of the cows. He's always the well-wisher of the cows. So there are many animals in creation, and they're all God's children. They trust us. Like Prabhupada was saying in the video, the worst sin is to violate a trust. A child's trust for its mother, a wife's trust for her husband, and vice versa, or an animal's trust for human beings. You know, these animals, they naturally trust us. And just like a child, when it lays its head on its mother's lap, to cut the throat of that child is the most heinous, unthinkable crime. So these animals, they're basically dependent upon us. They revere us. They worship us. They trust us. And so we can't violate that trust without becoming sinful. But of all the animals, the one which is most dear to Krishna is the cow. He even says in the Bhagavad Gita that of cows, among cows, I am the Sarabi. This is a quote from the 10th chapter, 28th verse. Chapter is entitled Opulences of the Absolute. Of weapons, I am the thunderbolt. Among cows, I am the Sarabi. Of causes for procreation, I am Kandarpa, that's Cupid. And of serpents, I am Vasuki. The Sarabi cow is a special cow which exists in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there are parrots. It says Krishna even has a couple of dogs. There's peacocks. Obviously, there's monkeys. But there's more than anything else, they're cows. More than anything else, they're cows. Vrindavan is a land of cows. And in Krishna's own spiritual abode, the cows, just like the desire trees, will give you anything you want. There are a few stories in the Mahabharata of some cows having come down onto this mortal world. One of them was owned by Vasishta. And Vishwamitra, who was a warrior at that time, arrived at Vasishta's ashram with an entire army, which was hungry. And Vasishta asked the cow to provide a feast for the army. And they all sat down. And just from this special desire-fulfilling cow, you had chutneys, and you had entrees, and you had all kinds of different rices, and many different varieties of breads, savories, sweets, all kinds of different drinks and all. In fact, as a result of that, Vishwamitra decided that he wanted to become a Brahmin, and so that he could have a Sarabi cow for himself. And so, in the descriptions of the spiritual world, it says, Chintamani Pakara Sadmashu Kalpa Vriksha Lakshmi Sahasra Sadbrahma Sevyamanam Govindam Aripurusham Tamahangajami. The stuff of that spiritual world is Chintamani, it's touchstone. The associates of the Lord are goddesses of fortune. The trees are desire trees, and the cows are Sarabi cows. Cows which can give anything that you need in the service of Krishna. One thing I like about this slideshow is there's lots of nice pictures about cows. There are seven mothers it's described. Atma Mata, Guru Patni, Brahmana Raji. The real mother is the mother. The wife of the spiritual master is the mother. The wife of the Brahmin is the mother, the wife of the king, the cow, as well as the nurse, and I don't even know what we've got here. Let's see. It's going a little bit below here. And the earth, okay? We all just drink our mother's milk for some short period of time at the beginning of our lives, and it helps us get strong, get protein, and develop good bones. But we continue drinking the cow's milk during the entirety of our life. And so if we're beholding to our mother for having given us her milk in the beginning of life, we should also regard the cow as a mother in as much as she's giving us milk throughout her whole life. When we're older, we don't drink as much milk as we do when we're young. When we're young, we can drink as much milk as we like because of our growth and our bones are being formed. When we're older, it's not a very healthy policy to overindulge in dairy products. But Prabhupada said, 12 ounces of dairy a day is very good. Before that was clarified in the early days of the movement, on that video, some of the devotees were talking about their early misconceptions in their zeal. And some devotees got so fired up about the idea of cows and dairy products that they would eat like whole tubs of cream cheese, exclusively, And before Prabhupada clarified, that even prasadam, it's best taken in moderation, there were a couple of devotees that started to get those veins. What do they call those veins? The varicose veins, because they were eating so many dairy products.
Too much ghee.
Too much ghee and sour cream and all like that. So anything's good in moderation, and anything's bad in excess. So just as much as the cow is the mother, the bull is the father. As much as the cow produces milk, the bull is big and strong. Any male that's been in the corral with our bull Nandi knows how like he's like a tank. Someone had let the door open in the back the other day, and they were all in the hay, and it was dark, and I was just coming back. So I went in to shoo them out of the hay thing, and to close the door. And before I knew it, I was on my back, and Nandi was like, gouging me, And he's so strong. But you take that strength and you yoke it up. You put a yoke and you put a plow behind him, or you put a bullock cart behind him, and then you have transportation. And as the cow goes, he renews the topsoil. Topsoil is basically just matter that decays. And so when the cows pass manure, it's a wonderful way of replenishing topsoil, because topsoil gets used up when it produces crops. And if you don't replenish it, eventually you won't have the means to feed yourself and to sustain yourself. All the petrochemical products that we import from the Middle East and we use as fertilizers, they make things grow, but they don't replenish the soil. So topsoil, we've lost more topsoil in this country in the last 15 years than we had in the previous 200 years before that. And in fact, in another 25 years, there won't be any topsoil left anywhere in America. Whereas if you use the cow, you don't have that problem. Prabhupada said, as soon as you introduce the tractor, then you no longer get renewable manure, you no longer get renewable topsoil, you put 20 people out of work. 20 people are out of work, and oftentimes, like in America, you have to support these people by welfare. And not only does the tractor not give good manure, good soil content, but it actually poisons the atmosphere. It does just the opposite with its exhaust. It poisons the atmosphere. And then also, there's so much energy that goes into producing petrol that the amount of energy that it takes to produce off of the land is multiplied exponentially as soon as you take the means of production away from people themselves. Similarly, the bull is the father of human society because the father earns for the children just as the bull tills the ground to produce food grains. Human society will kill its spirit of life by killing the father and the mother. So indeed, by the hard work of the bull, you get bread on the table. Just like Jerry has a wife and a child, and he goes to work and he puts bread on the table. Every father who's ever lived said, has the idea, my job is to put bread on the table. And so the cow does that. In the prasadam section, I mentioned going on a morning walk with Prabhupada in Mayapur. And Prabhupada heard about, you may remember this story, Prabhupada heard about two ladies in America that were observing Ekadasi for 1 year. For 1 year, they didn't eat any grains. And when Prabhupada heard that, he said, Very good. He said, grains are for animals. So then the whole movement, you know, stopped eating grains for about 2 weeks until Prabhupada was on another morning walk, and I was on both of these in Vrindavan. Vrindavan. The festival at which devotees come from all over the world is usually in March. And they go to Mayapur in West Bengal first to celebrate Lord Chaitanya's appearance day. And then the next 2 weeks they go to Vrindavan, and they're usually there for Ram Navami. So half of it's in Mayapur and half of it's in Vrindavan. So Prabhupada was on another morning walk in Vrindavan, and pretty much the whole movement had stopped eating grain by that time. And one devotee mentioned on this walk, said, you know, grains are for animals. He just said, grains are for animals. I don't eat grains either. They're for animals. Quoting Prabhupada, and he was said it in Prabhupada's hearing, thinking Prabhupada would be very pleased, you know, that he's quoting. And Prabhupada stopped, you know, and he said, I eat grains. Am I an animal? So, the two women that weren't eating grains, they weren't doing anything. They were just sitting, and they weren't doing any physical work. So, Prabhupada's point was that they don't need grains. But animals, especially the bull, which is the biggest and strongest of animals, he does hard work, pulling the plow and tilling the soil and pulling the ox cart. And so, if you're doing hard work, you do need to eat grains. So we do feed the bull grass and grains, but he produces grains too as a result of the energy that he gets from doing that. So there's the bull, the father. This is Balabhadra. He's been working with cows in New Vrindavan for many, many years, probably 30 years. And he has an organization called ISKALP. We're ISKCON, International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And he's got ISKALP, International Society for Cow Protection. And he's always had cows, and he's one of the very few people, he's the only person in this country that's actually successfully trained cows in the yoke. I don't know how many teams he's trained, probably a couple dozen teams with help, but he starts them out as young little boy, and he has to match them. They have to be matched according to size and weight and temperament. If they're brothers, that's the best. And then they learn commands for going right and going left and stopping and all like that. And then these are the same animals. They started out here, and he trained them. And then these are the same animals a few years later, weighing over 1,000 pounds. And they're very gentle animals. These oxen have been in use for padyatras, where devotees have traveled thousands of miles with an ox cart, pulling a cart with a deity of Prabhupada and a deity of Lord Chaitanya, and they weigh up to 1,200 pounds, depending on what variety it is, and they're just like devotees. They're just like devotees. Another useful aspect of the bull is hauling wood in a climate like New Vrindavan, West Virginia. There gets to be a lot of snow on the ground. And the only practical way to bring in wood, I mean, it's one thing to go out with a chainsaw and cut it, but you're going to drag it, logs through the snow that's waist high. I mean, it's tough enough just to walk, what to speak of dragging a slippery log behind you. So this is a very, very useful occupation for the bull to do that. And also, when you need transport, just to go on a bullock cart is very pleasing. It's not at a hectic pace. You can enjoy the scenery. You can chant your japa. You can think of God. Almost all activities, whether it be a bullock cart, or plowing in the field, the beauty of the bull is that he travels just at the right speed that you can still think. A horse might go faster, but then you can't think. You're just too preoccupied in trying to keep up with the horse and trying to think in advance of the horse and what the horse is going to do and plan ahead. But the bull just goes just at a right pace for divinity. It's a divine pace so that you don't have to be a peasant farmer. You don't have to be reduced to just physical part of you. But behind the plow that a bull's pulling or behind an ox cart, the pace is just such that you can still be a philosopher and still think philosophical thoughts while you're plowing or while you're on the back of an ox cart. And then just think of the motor car. All that we have to do to support the motor car, all these millions of miles of highway and all the work and the huge equipment $100,000 pieces of equipment that it takes to asphalt it, the maintenance, the taxes of it. Whereas a bull can go anywhere. You just need a dirt path, and the bull can go anywhere. And you can keep life very simple without it getting overly complicated. The bull is the emblem of the moral principle, and the cow is the representative of the earth. When the bull and the cow are in a joyful mood, it is to be understood that the people of the world are also in a joyful mood. The reason is that the bull helps production of grains in the agricultural field, and the cow delivers milk, the miracle of aggregate food values. The great saints and sages in the olden days used to go to the doors of the householders and just beg one cup of milk in the morning. It gave the householders an opportunity to do some service for the holy man. It gave them the opportunity to ask any questions that they had while the holy person was there. And the milk itself would nourish the finer tissues within the brain so that the holy man could understand spiritual subject matters. Somehow or other, cow milk does for the brain what goat milk and buffalo milk does not do. Don't ask me the chemistry of it, but that's just accepted as part of the culture. That buffalo milk is milk. Buffalo is an animal in the mode of ignorance, and cow is in the mode of goodness. And so buffalo milk may look the same as cow's milk. In fact, in India, they try to switch as much as they can. They try to cheat you by mixing the cow's milk with buffalo milk, or even with water, whatever they can get away with. But the results are different, very different, that you get from drinking buffalo's milk from drinking cow's milk. In fact, even a few years, just I think in about a year or so ago, when they examined ghee, you know, the product which in India is sold as cow's ghee, they found out that actually there was a lot of that was buffalo milk ghee. It wasn't really cow's ghee, and there was a cheating going on a large scale. So Prabhupada said the buffalo is in the mode of ignorance, and he said if you eat enough buffalo milk, it'll actually rot your brain. Whereas cow milk will give you a good brain. Rupa Goswami, you've heard this before, for instance, he was subsisting on the milk of a cow and dairy products just as recently as 500 years ago in India. And he had such a good brain from a combination of dairy and also continence that when he wrote his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, his nectar devotion, he would write it on leaves, and he would write page one on one side of a leaf, and then if he were to turn it over, it would smear. So he had to leave it dry, but he wanted to continue to write, so then he would write page three on another leaf. And by that time he'd written page three, then page one would dry. And then he'd go and he'd write page two, and then he'd write page four. So this was the kind of brain that they had as a result of practicing continence and drinking cow's milk, the miracle milk of the cow. The Lord Chaitanya had a discussion in West Bengal with the Qazi. The Qazi was the Muslim magistrate who was in charge of the area. And the Qazi had gotten complaints from the Brahmins, the caste-conscious Brahmins, about Lord Chaitanya disrupting Hindu society through the propagation of Sankirtanam. The caste-conscious Brahmins have always been against the idea of lower-class people becoming Krishna-conscious. And so they complained to the Qazi, and the Qazi broke the Madanga drum, and he said that Sankirtan should stop, and if it didn't stop, he would turn the practitioners into Muslims. And all he had to do in those days was just pour a little dirty water on a Hindu's head, and then he was outcast from the Brahmins took care of that. And so Lord Chaitanya, not only did he not stop the Sankirtan movement, but that night he had 100,000 people marching through the streets of the city with torches and drums. And they went through the city and they gathered more people and they gathered more momentum. And then the Qazi's soldiers wouldn't stay. They were scared. And the Qazi's bodyguards and the Qazi's soldiers, they all thought it would be better to be someplace else at that point in time. And so this huge Sankirtan party started marching right towards the Qazi's house, and all of his soldiers had deserted him. And he was upstairs hiding under the bed. Lord Chaitanya kind of stole his thunder. And then when Lord Chaitanya got there, he called up and he said, "I have no violent intentions. In fact, your father knew my father, and so I think of you as my uncle or your brother's brother. So please come down. I just want to have a discussion." And when the Qazi came down, of all the topics that Lord Chaitanya chose to discuss, it was this business of the role of the cow and the value of the cow and the sanctity of the cow. And the first question he asked the Qazi, he says, in Muslim religion, if someone kills their mother, what do they call that? And he says, well, matricide. He says, is that considered a sin? The Qazi said, oh yeah, it's a great sin. And Lord Chaitanya said, well, how about killing the father? What do you call that? Patras, is that a sin? He said, yes. So Lord Chaitanya, just to make the point clear, he said, so basically, in the Muslim scriptures, as well as our scriptures, it's a great sin to kill the mother and father, right? And the Qazi says, oh, yes, yes. So then Lord Chaitanya went on to explain how the bull is the father and the cow is the mother. And it's equally as great a sin to kill the bull and the cow. And he quoted examples from the Quran itself to back up his point. And the Qazi basically agreed with him by the end of their discussion. So this is an actual quote that Lord Chaitanya put to the Qazi. He said, since the cow and the bull are your father and mother, how can you kill and eat them? What kind of religious principle is this? On what strength are you so daring that you commit such sinful activities? So Lord Chaitanya considered this was a very important point. Refuting the Qazi's statement, the Lord immediately replied, what the Qazi had said is, he said, in your Vedas, it talks about killing animals. There's mention in the Vedas about killing animals. And Lord Chaitanya concedes the point. He says, yes, he says that there is mention in the Vedas about killing animals, but the Vedas clearly enjoin that cows should not be killed. First of all, if you're going to kill and eat an animal, don't take the cow. Take a goat or a dog or some lower class animal. But whatever you do, do not kill the cow. And then also he did mention that in old days, sometimes an animal, even cows, would be killed. But by mantra, the Brahmins would bring them back to life again and give them new bodies. It was a way of testing the particular Brahmin and his purity and his pronunciation of the mantras. Oh, you're a Brahmin? Okay, then do this. And if he did it, then he was a bona fide Brahmin. So it was not really violence because the animal was given a new body. But nobody can do that in this age. So if you can't give the old cow a new body, then there's no latitude whatsoever for killing a cow, especially in this age of Kali. And it may be mentioned in the Vedas, but it's not condoned. And there are five things, in fact, that are expressly forbidden in the age of Kali. One of them is the offering of a horse in sacrifice. The other one is the offering of a cow, because in neither case in Kali Yuga can you rejuvenate them and bring them back to life. And then the third thing is the acceptance of the order of sannyas, the offering of oblations of flesh to the forefathers and a man's begetting children in his brother's wife. That would be if the brother had died. If the brother had died, and then his brother, surviving brother, could beget children in his brother's wife. But even that is expressly forbidden in the age of Kali. Now Lord Chaitanya was born in Navadvip as the son of Jagannath Misra and Mother Sachi, and he was born in a Brahmin family. And one time, when Lord Chaitanya was asked, to what do you attribute your Brahmin birth? He says, Gopa Grihe Janme Chile. He says, in my last life I herded cows. And I got so much piety that then in this life I became a Brahmin. So he's making a reference that in his last life he was Krishna. In his last incarnation he was Krishna in Vrindavan. And Krishna used to take the cows out every day while they pastured and then bring them back. And so Lord Chaitanya is quipping by saying that he got birth in a Brahmin family in this life because in his last birth he herded the cows in Vrindavan. And here's a nice, this is really a nice painting. Isn't that a beautiful painting?
Yeah, it's a nice one.
Yeah, that's one of those Sharma pictures. It's Krishna with the gopis and the cowherd maidens and the cows. And here's a quote also. We can't see all of it here. Oh, sinless Yashoda, your darling child has festively enhanced his attire with a jasmine garland, and he is now playing along the Yamuna in the company of the cows and cowherd boys, amusing his dear companions. The gentle breeze honors him with its soothing fragrance of sandalwood, while the various demigods, standing on all sides, offer their music, singing, and gifts of tribute. So doesn't this make a beautiful scene? Can you imagine? any more idyllic, peaceful, some other right, perfect scene than Krishna with the cowherd girls and the cows. And the whole economy in Vrindavan was just based on this one principle, the cows. There was so much milk products that Krishna used to feed the milk to the monkeys. And then after the monkeys got so full they couldn't eat anymore, then Krishna would throw it on the ground and say to the gopis, your milk products are useless, even the monkeys won't take them. And when they had festivals, they would have yogurt fights. They would have butter fights where they would throw yogurt and butter. And Krishna is teaching, he's teaching us that you can never have too many cows, you can never have too much dairy product. That in fact the cow is the basis for a strong economy. We're thinking because of cheap petrol and cheap gas that the cow is like a luxury or it's a liability or it's something that needs to be managed. If we get too much dairy, then we have to kill the cows to cut down dairy production. Krishna says in civilized society there's no such considerations whatsoever. You have plenty of cows and you have plenty of dairy products. And we're going to see as we go in here all the usefulness to which the dairy products can be put. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti gives the following information about the transcendental cows of Vrindavan. Now these are Krishna's cows. And this is specific information from Vishwanath Chakravarti. For each of the four colors of cows, white, red, black, and yellow, there are 25 subdivisions, okay? Making a total of 100 colors. So there are 20, what is that? Maybe you can help me out with this. That means there's 100 different types of white cow. Is that right, what it means? 100 different types of red, 100 different black and yellow. And such qualities as being colored like sandalwood pulp, tealock, speckled, or having a head shaped like a madunga drum, create 8 further groups. To count these 108 groups of cows, so there's 4 and 25, that's 100 different kinds of cows, or each one is a group. So there's 25 groups, there's 100, and then there's some different, you know, whatever kind with different kinds of colors and different kinds of heads. So there's 108 groups of cows distinguished by color and form. And then Krishna has a string of 108 jeweled beads, and this is what he uses to keep track of his cows. So when Krishna calls out, hey, Davali, which is the name of a white cow, a whole group of white cows come forward. And when he calls Hamsi, Chandini, Ganga, Mukta, and so on, the 24 other groups of white cows come. So there's apparently one cow in charge of each group. The reddish cows are called Aruni, Kunkuma, Saraswati. The blackish ones, Shamala, Dumala, Yamuna. And the yellowish ones, Pita, Pingala, Haritalika, etc. Those in the group with tilak marks on their foreheads are called Chitrita, Chitratilaka, Dirgatilaka, Tiryaktilaka, and there are groups known as Madanga Mukhi, Shimha Mukhi, Lion Headed, Madanga Headed, and so on. Thus, being called by name, the cows are coming forward, and Krishna, thinking that when it is time to bring them back from the forest, none should be forgotten, is counting them on his jewel beads. So you see why it irks devotees when some Christian preacher gets up and he says, God, 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 God. I mean, where's the specifics? Where's the specifics? What does God do? What is his favorite? Who are his pets? And what are the names of all of his cows? I mean, is there anything like this in the history of religion in the world? You actually not only learn that God's favorite animal is a cow, you not only learn that God came here and revealed his form so we don't have to speculate about him, but we learn that he spent a significant portion of his time while on earth showing the importance of the cow by personally herding the cows, and he knew the names of them. When people come here, we have like 40 lamas, and people say, do you know their names? And I say, well, yeah. And they think that's really impressive, you know, the name of them. Well, I think it's like 108,000 cows that Krishna used to take out every day. 108,000 cows, and he knew the names of every single one of them. And he would count on his beads to make sure that they were all present and accounted for before they would go back to Vrindavan at the end of the day. So this is what I like about Krishna consciousness. I like the specifics, you know. It said To know someone is to love them. And that's not always the case in the material world, because people have secrets, and people have guilty pastimes, and people have guilty passions. And sometimes people keep things from other people because they're afraid that if they knew certain things about them, they would not love them, they would hate them, in fact. But to know Krishna is to love him, because in fact he is this, the all-attractive, supreme, lovable object. So the more information we can get about Krishna, the more we'll love him. And so to know him is to love him never is truer than it is in the case of God. And it's not enough just to bluff about God, 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 and surmise what his qualities are. I mean, that's all well and good, and that's all valid. But the more knowledge you have about God, the more you'll love him. And the less knowledge you have about God, the less your love will be able to expand and grow. So any God-conscious person should be willing to take advantage of the Vedic knowledge. It's not that they need to change their religion or convert from this or that. But in fact, we all need to learn more about God so that we become more lovers. And the more we become lovers, the more we'll be perfect ladies and gentlemen and get along with each other better. Now, this is also an instance where Krishna underlined the importance. There is very little that's more important for people who live by agriculture than rainfall. And Indra is in charge of rainfall. And so for many, many generations in Vrindavan, there had been a sacrifice to Indra, the king of rain. Nanda Maharaj did it, and his father did it, and his grandfather did it. So they were getting ready to do this annual sacrifice to Indra to ensure good rainfall. Just like we were seeing on the video, that devotees came to Hyderabad and there hadn't been any rain for a year. And during the time they had their Pandal program, they were chanting Hare Krishna, it rained. And it wasn't even monsoon. The monsoon season had passed and there hadn't been any rain. And it was past monsoon, it was a dry season, and it rained. So rain is very important when you're living agriculturally. And the sacrifice that was an annual event was offered to Indra, the king of rain. But Krishna talked his father out of it. And he said, let's offer to Govardhan Hill and let's offer to the cows, because we have a very intimate relationship with the cows. And the cows get nice fresh grasses. Govardhan Hill supplies nice fresh grasses and wandering area to the cows. And so Govardhan Hill is worshipable for that reason, because Govardhan is serving the cows. Therefore, we should worship Govardhan Hill. So important is the worship of the cows. And then, of course, we all know the story that when Indra... And Nanda Maharaj, first of all, he said, well, okay, Nanda Maharaj didn't argue. He acknowledged that the cows were central in the life of Vrindavan. And he didn't argue. He just said, let's do the Indra sacrifice, and then we'll do another sacrifice for the cows. But Krishna didn't allow that. He wanted to make his point in no uncertain terms. So he said, no, all the paraphernalia that we've already got, it's all ready, so let's just do it, but do it for Govardhan, do it for the cows. And then don't worry about Indra, I'll take care of that. Just like he says in the Bhagavad Gita, give up all varieties of religion, just surrender unto me, in return I will protect you, have no fear. So they went ahead and they did that. And then what happened was, after Indra tried to drown all the inhabitants of Vrindavan and sent his storm clouds and all, and then Krishna counteracted it. Indra came and he apologized to Krishna for being an upstart. And he came down and he bowed down and he brought a Sarabi cow with him, and the Sarabi cow showered Krishna with milk, and Ganges water came from the milk of the cow. And Indra, at that time, during his prayers, it is said, here, Indra and the cow took this opportunity to bestow upon the Lord the name Govinda. And the demigod showered flowers and recited various prayers there. So, at least if we believe this story, this is from when Krishna became known as Govinda. And Go means cow, it means senses, and means land. So Govinda means protector of the cows, pleaser of the senses, and the owner of all land. And wherever you see a Hare Krishna restaurant anywhere in the world, it'll most likely be called Govindas, because the most tasty items are always based on the product of the cow. If you have enchiladas, Hanuman's enchiladas, you'll notice there's a lot of cheese in them. If you make lasagna, you got to have all different kinds of cheese in it. You know, all the quiche is cheese. You know, all these. I mean, just look at it. All we get, milk, we get sour cream, we get ricotta, we get cream cheese, we get ice cream, we get shredded cheese, we get mozzarella cheese, we get buttermilk, and we get all kinds of things just from the milk of the cow. So she's a veritable fount of generosity. And all she eats is just grass. So such a deal, grass in one hand, and then life-giving milk on the other hand. Now, part of that Govardhan Puja ceremony that Krishna, they already had all the paraphernalia for worship for Indra, but Krishna wanted them to cook a big feast for Govardhan. And so he inspired them, in addition to the paraphernalia for worshiping Indra, he inspired them to cook a big feast. And guess what was the main ingredient for most of the really, really tasty items? It was dairy products. So all these different things in the Anukuta here, probably 90% of them are all made with dairy. And you can almost see there's no two trays that are alike. It wasn't like someone decided, oh man, this is too much work, so I'll put four of the same thing up there, you know. I'll just make more of it. Every single one of those is different. And, oh, yeah, at least. Some temples offer 1,008. Yeah. And, yeah, milk product. Not everything, but most of it. Most of it's milk product. It's said here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a miracle in milk, for it contains all the necessary vitamins to sustain human physiological conditions for higher achievements. Brahminical culture can advance only when man is educated to develop the quality of goodness, and for this there is a prime necessity of food prepared with milk, fruits, and grains. Now, ideally, we don't want to buy milk from the market for several reasons. One is, it's processed, it's pasteurized, and all the goodness of it has been killed by the way they pasteurize it. And the other reason is that after the dairy cow is no longer a viable economic unit, they do to it the same thing they do to a cow for meat. And we'd rather not, in fact strongly, rather not support with our purchases that kind of violence. So Prabhupada wanted us to have farms, he wanted us to have cows, he wanted us to base our economy on the cow rather than the motor car. And whenever we would have our own cows, of course, we wouldn't have to take the goodness out of them by the elaborate process of pasteurization that the government requires. And then if that milk were to be sold, a certain percentage of this profits from the sale of the milk products would go to purchase land so that the cows could be supported until they died a natural death. In India, this is the system called Goshala. I'm sure you saw that in Vrindavan. Goshala. Go means cow and shala means shelter. And many, many wealthy people, as a means of charitable work, will bequeath a percentage of their income or a percentage of their legacy to purchasing land and supporting cows that are old and that don't give milk anymore. And they're just allowed to live out their natural lives in a goshala. ISKCON is the largest, I'm not sure if I included this in this show or not, it may come later, I'm not sure, but there was something over the internet recently where they had a big convention of all the people that were interested in cow protection in India, and ISKCON was especially recognized as the largest cow protection organization in the world, that no other single organization runs as many goshalas as ISKCON does. And in fact, especially in India, wherever there's a temple, there's always cows. And those cows are never sold. They're always protected, and they're led to die a natural death. Unfortunately, we haven't yet learned the art of supporting ourselves economically from the cows. We're under the misimpression that the cow is something to be subsidized. But actually, the cow itself can support and fund all of your projects if you know how to do it, if you know the art. And so we're just trying to transition from a mindset of keeping cows as like a charity to the actual reality of the situation is if you know what to do with the cows and the cow's product, it can be a source of real wealth, of real, real wealth. And we're going to talk about that a little bit now, I think. Did I read this? There's a did I already read that? Okay. All right. The cow is the most important animal for developing the human body to perfection. The body can be maintained by any kind of foodstuff, but cow's milk is particularly essential for developing the finer tissues of the human brain so that one can understand the intricacies of transcendental knowledge. Another thing is, many people in the Western countries have developed what they call lactose intolerance. They can't take dairy products. And one of the contributing factors to that is that milk is not meant to be drunk cold. It comes from the cow, it's hot, and then you heat it further, and milk should be taken so that it's just, it doesn't burn the tongue, but it's close. It should be taken as piping hot as possible, but without burning the tongue. That way the milk directly absorbs through the bloodstream. Whereas cold milk is very, very difficult. It's almost indigestible. And it's no wonder that you get an intolerance for it after some time. On the other hand, hot milk is very life-giving and immediately absorbed into the body. And then especially just before you go to bed at night, we did that for some time here and we seem to be off and on with it. But when I was a new devotee, we always ended the day with banana nectar. That was a staple every day. Just before you go to bed, you'd have a big pot. Remember that, by Bobby? And it would be milk, and it would have all these banana pieces floating in it. And we'd drink a couple of that cups of that, and that acts to put you to sleep. I mean, that just puts you right to sleep, and you wake up rested in the morning. So here's a collage here. All the different dairy products, cheddar, feta cheese, what is it called? Kefir. There's yogurt, there's sour cream, cottage cheese, cream cheese, ricotta, all kinds of things here. I don't know why they call, there's no eggs in this picture, but a lot of pictures on the internet, they'll have, I couldn't use the pictures because they had eggs in there. I don't know why they call eggs dairy. They don't come from a cow, do they? Why are eggs called dairy products?
You milk the chicken.
I don't know. But a lot of pictures, you know, on the internet, you said dairy products, and then there'll be a big, you know, dozen eggs in there, so I couldn't use those. Now these are all made from milk. These are just sweets. You know, forget about entrees made with milk products like paneer and all. These are just sweets. They're all made from milk, and they're just from Orissa. There's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18 different kinds of sweets, and they're specialties in Orissa. And Orissa is only one of 18 states in India. And every state has its special dairy-based sweets. You know, India is a place for sweets. You know, I think we were seeing on the video here in Hyderabad that one very big man in Hyderabad, when Prabhupada did his public programs there in 1972, he became so impressed with Prabhupada that he donated land for a temple. But it wasn't an entirely selfless donation. His name was Reddy, and he had a big sweet shop on Nampali Station Road. So what he did was, he donated the land right behind the sweet shop. So everybody who goes to the temple has to go past his sweet shop. Very intelligent guy. Very intelligent guy like that. And even today, I asked the devotee, I was in Hyderabad like 1973, maybe not that Pana, but the next one. And I asked the devotees, you know, I said, does Mr. Reddy still have his sweet shop right in front of the temple? I said, he sure does. So you got gulab jamun, burfi, sandesh, rasamalai. What else?
Rasgulla.
All kind. You could go on and on and on and on and on. All dairy products. One of the most famous pastimes in the scriptures is that of the churning of the ocean of milk. It's believed that within the universe there's an ocean of milk. And one time, the demigods and the demons, they combine forces. And you see this really beautiful painting here of the demons and the demigods. And they took Vasuki, the snake, and they used him as a churning rod. They used Mount Sumeru as the flap, you see. We were just talking today, Hanuman was talking about going the extra mile and how it sometimes pays off. And I told him a story I'd read somewhere about three frogs that fell into a bucket of milk. And they were flapping to get out, but they didn't have any traction. There wasn't any solid ground with which to hoist themselves up. So they were just flapping their webbed feet for some time. And one got tired and he said, "What's the point?" And he just gave up and he sunk and he drowned. And then there were just two left. And then the second one, after a while, he still had some strength left, but he just couldn't see the point. So he just gave up and he just sunk under the surface and he drowned. And the third one, he was just going to do it. He was just going to flap and flap and flap and flap, no matter what. But he was getting tired. He was coming to the end of his strength. He was flapping and flapping and flapping. And he didn't know how much more he could do it. And he was really at the end of his strength. And he was just ready to go under. And he thought, I'll just do it one more time. I don't even have this. I'll just do it one more time. And he did it one more time. And the milk turned to butter. And then it provided a semi-solid footing so he could jump out like that. So there's actually a whole major pastime. And this goes through many cultures. In fact, in the international airport in Bangkok, there's a huge sculpture of this very same scene of the demigods and the demons churning the ocean of milk. And what was their purpose? That they were going to get the nectar of long life and immortality. And they're getting it from milk. So notice the meaningness of this, that it's from milk, that they, in churning the milk, they get the nectar of immortality. And Nitya, as you know, is trained in Ayurveda. And she gives this wonderful class, which I've heard a couple of times, about the wonders of ghee. Golden butter, which is produced by churning milk. And the golden color comes from the sun. It actually captures the potency of the sun. And we all know that good health comes from the sun. In the Vedic culture, if you are an athlete and you want good health, you worship the sun god. And you start off your day by doing the series of exercises called Surya Namaskar. It's said that if you key on the sun in this way and do your Surya Namaskar, you'll never experience ill health. And so that's captured, that flavor and that potency of the sun is captured in butter products and ghee products. Also, you'll notice, I think, somewhere here, there's a cow. One of the products that's churned from the ocean of milk, aside from the elixir of immortality, one of them is also a cow. The Sarabi cow comes originally. All these good things come from milk. And then, of course, the fire sacrifice, the Agnihotra, is described. The cow. Gosh, I don't know how to get this all on the screen here. The cow is described as Havardhani. The Sarabi cow is described as Havardhani. Havi means butter. It means butter for the fire sacrifice. And Dhani means a gift. You know, in other words, as a result of her what she produces, you can perform the fire sacrifice. And here you have the Brahmin. And he's got his shrak here. Shrak, this is a wooden spoon. And every time he pours a ghee on the fire, he says, Svaha, which means let it be consumed. So the way that you propitiate the gods and get their blessings in your life is you offer a certain auspicious blend of grains called samagri, and then you use to combust the fire a ghee, pure golden cow's ghee, and you say, Svaha, and that brings all auspicity, whether it be a birth of a child or naming of a child or buying a new house or starting any sort of endeavor. So the cow is described as Havardhani, the source of butter. The performance of sacrifice is essential. To perform yajna, clarified butter is absolutely necessary, and to get clarified butter, milk is necessary. Clarified butter, by the way, is obtained by just taking regular butter and putting it over low flame for, what, a couple of hours? And then
you boil it.
You boil it over a low flame, and then the solids that are in butter, which is about less than 10% of the volume, they sink to the bottom. And then you just scoop out the clear golden ghee, or clarified butter, which is on the top, leaving the solids. And interestingly enough, ghee doesn't have to be refrigerated, because all the impurities that would have gone rancid have been removed by the process of making the ghee. So you can literally keep ghee at room temperature. I remember when we were in Australia from 70 to 75, they made really good ghee there, and they sold it in 40-pound lots. And I remember it was $40. It was $40 for 40 pounds. It was $1 a pound for ghee. And they used to bring it in cardboard boxes. It had plastic and cardboard box. And we just keep it under the table in the kitchen, and we just, with an ice cream scoop, we just go under and we just get what we needed for frying or cooking or whatever. And Prabhupada liked that ghee. It was called a Lowry's ghee. He liked it so much that I shipped twice a year. I shipped a huge quantity of that ghee to Mayapur so they could use it for all their cooking as well. Since cow protection is recommended everywhere in the scriptures, the Brahmana Vadis took charge of the Sarabi cow, in which the demons were not very interested. Yeah, so when the ocean of milk was churned to get nectar, many other auspicious things were produced, and one of them was the Sarabi cow. Now, the demons weren't interested in obtaining possession of the Sarabi cow, which is very interesting. The demons are not interested in cow protection, they're interested in meat eating and exploiting the cow, not in protecting the cow. They would just see the Sarabi cow as a headache. Why keep the cow alive for its whole lifespan? Just grow it up and then kill it and eat it for meat. But the fact is that a dairy cow, at least, that lives its whole life will give more than 100,000 gallons of milk. Whereas a cow which is raised for slaughter will only give 700 pounds of meat. So the cow is more economically valuable alive than dead. Of course, the cows that we see in Utah and in America are mostly a hybrid breed of cow which is produced for meat. And they're not really valuable in terms of milk production because they've been bred for meat. So when we say a cow, we really mean a dairy cow, like a Brown Swiss, a Jersey, a Guernsey. And they will produce literally more than 100,000 gallons of milk and be much more valuable alive than dead. And then when they die a natural death, Prabhupada said those who like to eat meat, they can then take the carcass of the naturally died cow and eat the meat. And you can also additionally use the leather and all the other products from the hide of the naturally deceased cow. When I first started going to India in the early 70s, the shoe stores, which sold leather shoes, had little tags on the shoes that assured the consumer that the leather was from a cow that had died a natural death, because people had those kinds of scruples in those days. I haven't noticed those kinds of tags since the 90s, so I'm kind of scared to think what that might possibly mean. Panchagavya are the five things that come from the cow. Milk, yogurt, ghee, cow dung, and cow urine, they're required in all ritualistic ceremonies performed according to the Vedic directions. And here's cow urine and cow dung are uncontaminated, and since even the urine and dung of a cow are important, we can just imagine how important this animal is for human civilization. The cow dung, as I said, fertilizes the field. It's used for insulating. You can smear it inside the house and it will insulate, keep it warm in the winter and keep it cool in the summer, and it will also provide an antiseptic effect on the, and then also it is used for cooking fuel. It has a nice slow burning effect, so you can use it for your cooking as well. And people go around and they collect the dry patties in the field, and you'll see young girls and young boys in the fields, and you'll see them kneel down, they have a basket, and they'll put them all in their head and bring them back at the end of the day. So cow dung is important. I was going into the library Monday, I was headed into the library, and I was outside in the parking lot, and I coughed, and there was some guy, he looked a little weird, But he came past me, and he was looking at me real hard. He says, cover your mouth when you cough. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm in the parking lot. You know, I mean, what are you talking about? He says, cover your mouth when you cough. That's the truth. And I said, all right, you know, I'm in the parking lot, you know. But why do we do that? Why do we cover our mouth? Because our secretions are contaminating. They'll infect other people. But it said that the cow, everything that comes out of it, even its snot and its urine and its stool and all that, it's all pure. It's all pure and uncontaminated. And sometimes we, you know, we notice that the cows, the llamas, they'll all poop in one little pile and so on and so forth. The cows, they'll go everywhere, you know. But if your stool is pure, then what do you have to worry about where you're pooping? So, all the secretions are pure. And what's more, and this is interesting, one time devotees were with Prabhupada, and one devotee said, oh, the cows are so beautiful. Cows are the most beautiful animal. And Prabhupada looked at him and said, cow is not the most beautiful animal. Horse is the most beautiful animal. Cow is not the most beautiful. Cow is the most generous animal, but it's not the most beautiful animal. But still, it's a beautiful picture to see the cow and the baby calf nursing like that. So these are now in Mayapur and Vrindavan, they're starting to do what I was talking about. And I'm not an expert. But Prabhupada emphasized that you can build your economy on the products of the cow. It should not be a drain. It should not be subsidized. It will pay for itself and it will give you profits as well. So these are some of the products now. Gomata. Mata means mother and go means cow. So these are some of the products. This is the this is the brand name, Ancient Secrets of Rejuvenation Therapy, and you have this is cow urine. It builds. They did a scientific study that after drinking you know, a little bit of cow urine every day for a month, depending on what breed of cow it was, the immune system of the people that took it had increased by up to 120%. It was 120% stronger immunity than before they did that. And so the cow urine is pure. It'll cure liver diseases. It'll solve digestion and build up your immune system. And then these are cow dung and for burning. And there's all various types of products. There's a company now, a major company, like the Indian version of Pepsi-Cola, that's in the process of marketing a soda made of cow urine. It may be even available when I go there. Who knows?
Check it out.
It'll be like a soda with one of the ingredients of which is cow urine. Agriculture is still the mainstay for India's economy. Cow breeding and cow preservation are integral to it. 75% of Indians live in villages and derive the greatest benefits from cows and bullocks. Despite the compulsions of modernism, tractors are not suitable for Indian land holdings. In the U.S., the land available to each person is around 14 acres. In India, it is only 0.7 acre. A tractor consumes diesel, creates pollution, doesn't eat grass, nor produces dung for manure. So for Indian conditions, plowing with the bull is still ideal. Albert Einstein, in a letter to Sir C.V. Raman, wrote, quote, tell the people of India that if they want to survive and show the world path to survive, then they should forget about tractor and preserve their ancient tradition of plowing. A clinical dietitian's chart will show that beef with 22% protein ranks far below vegetable products like soybean with 43% protein, ground nut 31%, and pulses 24%. Moreover, excess intake of protein is not good, as it only contributes to obesity, a bane of modern civilization. To procure 1 kilogram of beef, or for that matter flesh, it takes 7 kilograms of crops and 7,000 kilograms of water. This contributes to water shortage in regions where beef is prevalent. And this is from a website called mothercow.org. One of the common questions people say that if you eliminate meat or beef from your diet, how will you get protein? But the average American get 6 times more protein a day than is good for them. And the average vegetarian in America gets 3 times more protein than is good for them. And when you have too much protein in your body has to work extra hard to excrete it. And when it excretes excess protein, that protein leaches out calcium also. And that's why in big meat-eating countries, osteoporosis, the porosity of bones, is epidemic. It's epidemic like that. It doesn't matter how many supplements you take, calcium supplements you take. If you're ingesting too much protein, your bones will become brittle and porous, and you will get osteoporosis. Weightlifters now, bodybuilders, have discovered that the potato has just the right amount of protein. It has the right amount of protein, fiber, and carbohydrates. So that if you take too much protein, protein does help repair tissues. When you exercise or you lift weights, you tear, you have all kinds of mini tears. And then you need protein to repair those. And then when they repair, they get stronger. But when you get too much protein, it has a reverse effect. And the body has to work too hard. So you're working out for nothing. And those who are scientific about their bodybuilding now, they only want about 7-8% protein in their diet. And the average American has 15-20% protein. The average vegetarian has 12 or 14% protein. So there isn't anybody suffering from a protein deficiency. But even vegetarians in this country are suffering from excess protein. And of course, Maharaj Parikshit, when he came 5,000 years ago, Maharaj Parikshit was king of the world, and he was traveling around the world, and he came to a place where the personality of this age, Kali, a low-class man, was beating the cow and cutting the legs of the bull. And Maharaj Parikshit said, first of all, he's going to kill the wrongdoer, because he felt that killing a cow was as egregious a sin as killing a man. There was no difference. And even in the Bible, in the Old Testament, it says, God says, he who killeth an ox, it is as if he killed a man. So Maharaj Parikshit said, killing is killing, and it's equally serious whether you're killing a cow or killing a human being. And so he was going to punish the offender. And one of the things that he said in his outrage, he said that never before, and his dynasty, you know, his father was Abhimanyu, his grandfather was Arjuna, his great-grandfather and they had ruled the world, you know, the Kauravas had ruled the world for thousands of years. And he said, never before in the rule of any of my forefathers has a cow ever been injured. Has a cow ever been abused. Now, basically he was saying that up until his reign 5,000 years ago, nobody had ever abused a cow. This is the first time that anyone abused a cow by beating it. And nowadays, the executive heads of state, they don't even think twice about sending millions and millions of cows to the slaughterhouse. Grains and vegetables can sumptuously feed man and animals, and a fatty cow delivers enough milk to supply a man sumptuously with vigor and vitality. If there is enough milk, enough grains, enough fruit, enough cotton, enough silk, enough jewels, then why do the people need cinemas, houses of prostitution, and slaughterhouses? Anyone want to answer the question? Anyone want to say, well, I know why. Give a good reason. What is the need of an artificially luxurious life of cinema cars, radio, flesh, and hotels? Has this civilization produced anything but quarreling individually and nationally? Has this civilization enhanced the cause of equality and fraternity by sending thousands of men into a hellish factory and the war fields at the whims of a particular man? Oh, and this is a famous story about the karmic effects of participating in the death of a cow. It's said in the Bhagavatam that when a cow is killed, there's a gang of six who are considered co-conspirators in the death of that cow, and they're equally guilty. Just like in a court of law, if a man comes up on the stand and he says, I did not kill this person, but I hired someone to kill them, then he's equally guilty. So there are six people that share in the guilt of killing a cow. The person that raises the cow, the person that transports the cow, the person that cuts the cow, person that cooks the cow, the person that buys the cow, and the person that eats the cow. It's called the Gang of Six, and they're all equally responsible. So Narada Muni, he was traveling through one time, and he met four people, and he wanted to benedict each one according to their karma. So the first person he met was a king, and the king was enjoying life, and he was taking wine sometimes, and he had many wives and all. And so the king said, "Benedict me, Narada Muni." And he said, and so Narada benedict, and he said, "Long live the king," just like people always say, "Long live the king." He said, "Long live the king, because when you die, you're going to become a dog." Running after so many she-dogs and drinking in the lake. So have a long life, because when you die, you're going to become a dog. And then he came to a brahmachari, a very austere, ascetic, sort of a yogi person. And he had already given up. He was celibate. He hardly ate anything. I mean, he was already completely detached from the world. And so the Narada Muni benedicted him. He said, the king, he said, "Live long." The brahmachari, he said, "Die." He said, "Die. Because you don't want anything in this world, and when you go, you'll be so elevated." So one, he said, "Live," and the other said, "Die." Then he came to a devotee, someone who was serving Krishna, and he said, "Live or die, it doesn't matter, because you're serving Krishna now, you'll be serving, so, you know, it doesn't matter. Live or die, it doesn't matter." You know? Then he came to a butcher, and he didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to do. He said, "If I benedict you to live, then you'll go on killing the cows. And if I benedict you to die, then for every hair on the back of every cow that you've killed, you'll have to take birth as a cow and go to the slaughterhouse." So he said, "Don't live and don't die. Don't live and don't die." That's the best that he could do for the person involved in cow and killing. In every scripture, cow killing is vehemently condemned. Indeed, one who kills a cow must suffer for as many years as there are hairs on the body of a cow. Manu Samhita says, "Those who desire to eat meat may satisfy the demands of their tongues by eating lower animals, but they should never kill cows who are actually accepted as the mothers of human society because they supply milk." Cow killing is prohibited, and even if you want to go to kill a goat or some lower animal, you do it on a dark moon night. Because in not too long ago in India, people were ashamed. They would never do something like this in broad daylight. But they would wait until it was a dark moonlight, and then they would say a mantra before killing the goat, "Mamsa." And it means that as I am doing to you in this life, I give you permission to do in my next life. So I'm killing you in this life, you get to come back, and if you want, you can kill me in the next life. And the Hindi word for meat is M-A-N-S-E, mangsh, which is the same thing. Me and him, what I'm doing to him, he can do to me in the next life. But even so, it's not allowed to let that extend to the cow. This is only for lesser animals. For the cow, it's not just me and him, but it's for every hair on the back of the cow that you get the karma. I couldn't find that picture on the internet. I don't know what happened. I tried all kinds of search words, but I couldn't find that picture that we have, so I got something else. I don't know what it says, but anyway, shows you some of the reaction. Mom saw me and him. The cow's calf is not only beautiful to look at, but also gives satisfaction to the cow, and so she delivers as much milk as possible. But in the Kali Yuga, the calves are separated from the cows for purposes which may not be mentioned in these pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. The cow stands with tears in her eyes. The Sudra milkman draws milk from the cow artificially, and when there is no milk, the cow is sent to be slaughtered. These greatly sinful acts are responsible for all the troubles in present society. I often at this point quote a poem. We shape ourselves the joys and fears of which the coming life is made, and fill our future's atmosphere with sunshine or with shade. So a country that kills so many hundreds of thousands of cows, would we think that the future is going to be one of sunshine or one of shade? That's the reason the cow produces milk, because of her affection for the calf. Nowadays, they take the calf away, especially if it's a bull calf, they take it away, and then artificially, they pump the cow full of chemicals in order to make it produce more milk. I was reading an article today about antibiotics fed to livestock. You know why farmers feed antibiotics to livestock? I was shocked. I was shocked. It's not to keep them from getting sick. I mean, that's part of it, but that's a small part of it. It makes them grow faster. So they buy truckload, and you know, the pharmaceutical companies give them a discounted price. So they buy truckloads of antibiotics, and they just put in the food. One pig farmer, he got scored by a boar. He got between a boar and a sow, and he kind of got him with his tusk. And he got a staph infection. And there was no antibiotic that could deal with it. And then he had his whole herd tested, and they all had the same immunity. They had the same immunity. The bacteria in them had the same immunity to the antibiotics. You see what I'm saying? And so when he got cut by the bull, the bacteria that came with that was immune to the antibiotics because it had already learned how to change itself to deal with that particular antibiotic. And that only comes when you're massively overusing this. And they're coming to the point now, they're having to come up with a new antibiotic every 6 months. Because the bacteria is getting so smart now that it's finding out very quickly how to deal with the new antibiotics. So the lifespan of an antibiotic is about 6 months. And they predict that the time is coming very soon when we just won't be able, we won't have anything. We'll just run out of options. And at that time, there'll be a plague like the likes of which you've never seen in the history of the world. That's the doomsday or scenario that they're painting. But this is all massively accelerated. This would not happen, just even doctors over-prescribing. You know, we know the doctors over-prescribe antibiotics for human beings. But that would not have anything virtually to do with a pandemic. It would all be because of the massive use of antibiotics for livestock. And it's not to protect them from disease. It's so they grow faster. Can you believe that? And any legislation to the effect of cutting down or reducing or eliminating the use of antibiotics to livestock is blocked by the megalithic pharmaceutical companies because they're making tons and tons of money off of it. Okay, here's what I mentioned before. This is Vrindavan, and this is the Goshala. Yashoda lived in Vrindavan for 4 months. So this is the Goshala, and as I mentioned, ISKCON. ISKCON is the largest single... This was a certificate that was just given last week to Bhakti Raghava Swami by the Society for Cow Protection in India. They said ISKCON is the single largest organization in the world to run maximum number of Goshalas across the world. Speaking at the Vishwamangala Go Gaur Grama Yatra's conclusion program held 12-17-09, that was just a couple weeks ago, in Hyderabad, Mr. Uma Maheshwar Rao, president of the Vishwamangala Go Grama Baba Yada Yada, expressed his deep appreciation to ISKCON, ISKCON's effort in cow protection, not only in India, but across the world. But ISKCON is just getting it. It's just starting to get it. How the cow is not just a charitable endeavor to be subsidized and a drain on your resources. They're just starting to get it together now to view the cow as, in fact, the great boon that she is, and to start to build a strong economic future on all the products of Go Mataji Ki Jai.